This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello out there, everybody, and welcome to the Men's Hour, brought to you by Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Our first story is going to come to us from Newsweek magazine, from the edition dated November 14th. And our first one is about a long-standing country music star. Straight from the heart. Kenny Chesney's grit and authenticity have earned him a string of hits and a legion of fans, his No Shoes Nation. Yet, despite his induction into the Country Music Hall of Fame, the singer-songwriter is not slowing down. Kenny Chesney walks around Newsweek's office on the 72nd floor of One World Trade Center in New York City, peering out the floor-to-ceiling windows in search of his skyline barometers, the Statue of Liberty, the Brooklyn Bridge, and one of his favorite places to perform, MetLife Stadium. Both a sports stadium and concert venue, MetLife blends the two passions that built the music giant who was once a small-town football dreamer. Eight times MetLife has played host to a sea of fans, No Shoes Nation devotees, who come to soak in Chesney's unique blend of country, rock, and island music, paired with his positive, easy energy. His most recent show there in 2024 drew his largest crowd at the venue with more than 61,000 in attendance. "It's one of the most amazing nights of the summer," Chesney told Newsweek's editor-in-chief Jennifer H. Cunningham about his MetLife performances. "It reminds me of being in a Southern Baptist church with my grandmother. And when it's really good and everybody's feeling the Holy Spirit, you don't want to be anywhere else. It's amazing. It's the same way with the show. Each one," he says, "has a different pulse, bringing together new people and energy, creating an irreplaceable thrill." From MetLife to Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, to the Sphere in Las Vegas, millions have turned out across the country for an artist who has repeatedly topped the charts, sold more than 30 million albums, launched a radio channel, and been named Billboard's top country artist of the 21st century. The eight-time Entertainer of the Year, four each by the Academy of Country Music Awards and the Country Music Association, has racked up 33 number one hits on Billboard's Country Airplay chart. His most streamed track on Spotify, American Kids from 2014, has netted nearly half a billion listens. "I have an insane amount of gratitude, but it still doesn't feel real," he tells Cunningham in October, a week before accepting his latest accolade, his induction into the Country Music Hall of Fame, alongside the late June Carter Cash and Tony Brown. Chosen by an anonymous CMA panel that annually names three inductees, Chesney secured the 2025 Modern Era Artist title, joining just 158 artists to receive the genre's highest honor. "So honestly, I haven't emotionally and mentally accepted it yet," he adds. Days later, Chesney, who routinely puts music legends on a higher register than himself, posed with nearly two dozen Hall of Famers at the ceremony, including Randy Owen of Alabama, and the king of country music, George Strait, who were both profoundly formative and inspiring to Chesney in his childhood and early career years. Alabama was one of Chesney's first concerts as a kid, a foundational moment of his childhood that he details in his new memoir, Heart Life Music, written with Holly Gleason. Their helicopter entrance, the live music, the lyrics, everything cracked open a world that resonated with him. "I'll never get over the feeling," he writes, "of that first Alabama concert." Beyond the music, he remarked on the band members' grounded presence, noting they were rare because they felt more like us than fancy stars, an inspiration he's carried forward in his own casual demeanor. Both Alabama and Strait took Chesney on the road in his early days and showed him the ropes. Chesney filled an opening slot on Strait's Country Music Festival tour in a run that coincided with the popularization of his 1999 song, "She Thinks My Tractor's Sexy." Chesney knew it had landed when a group of high school students in tuxedos and dresses sent a video of themselves riding John Deere tractors to the prom with the song blasting. That connectivity fueled him further. Chesney told the audience during the Hall of Fame induction speech, "Walking into that rotunda and taking the group shot with a lot of my heroes and a lot of my friends, it was the first time that I ever felt accomplished in my life. With every cell in my body, I feel the gravity of this moment." But success and fame haven't shaken the 57-year-old from his small-town East Tennessee roots, nor his character. He appears unassuming in a beanie, hoodie, pants, and white sneakers when he arrives at Newsweek's global headquarters for his newsmakers interview. At times, with his easy demeanor and beaded bracelets, a nod to his life away from the limelight in the U.S. Virgin Islands, he barely seems to register his acclaim and the weight of his accomplishments. But after changing into a cream long-sleeve shirt for the interview and photo shoot, Chesney sets his signature sandy woven cowboy hat on his head. Touching the speckled brim of his Stetson, he explains that it transforms him. So this turns me from the kid that dreamed in East Tennessee to the guy up there on stage. It's two different personas. I like this guy, he says of his cowboy hat wearing self, adding, but I like the other guy too. If I carry the persona with me all the time, it would exhaust me. The hat changes his silhouette and reinforces his star aura, but it doesn't shift the person and values underneath. Chesney stays grounded, grateful, and faithful in pursuit of the simple joys in life, living largely by the mantra of his memoir, Heart, Life, Music. That laid-back manner belies an ambition and drive that powers Chesney. Widely listened to for decades, his staying power comes from his plain-spoken nature, his genuineness, and relatability as much as his determination and hard work. Coming up from East Tennessee. The son of a teacher and sports coach dad and a beautician mom who split up before his first birthday, Chesney credits his parents with instilling important values in him early on: grit, faith, community, and love. As a kid surrounded by women, his grandmother, sister, cousins, aunts, and his mother's beauty shop regulars, Chesney soaked up stories, gossip, and themes he'd later fold into early songs, even thumbing through Cosmopolitan for inspiration. Part of being a songwriter is to listen, read, hear all the stories, watch the people, and then make something out of it, he writes. Beyond the beauty shop, the football field and church were formative sites. For the teenager, putting on his helmet to play football on Friday nights wasn't just a celebration of the sport, it was a showcase of community and hard work. He still calls those Friday nights some of his happiest moments. Church, a temple for spiritual guidance and community, was also an early sonic site for Chesney, describing it as the first place I truly heard music and realized the way it can lift you up. He's chased that same bright collective lift for his fans ever since. Flush with a string of hit records now, the early days weren't quite as easy. One of his first songs, recorded on a cassette, was flat out rejected by Amy, a crush from his percussion course at East Tennessee State University. There he joined his first band, a bluegrass outfit that somehow landed him in Russia for a gig, and started out his first solo stint at a Mexican restaurant, fielding endless Margaritaville requests. After graduating in 1990, he moved to Nashville, the Music City, picking up performances at local bars. 3 years later, Chesney secured a contract with Capricorn Records with his debut album, In My Wildest Dreams, released in 1994. Momentum came when Alabama's manager, Dale Morris, took Chesney under his wing, the two trusting each other enough to not formalize it with a contract. Early on, Chesney made long journeys on the road to play half-empty venues and dealt with people mixing up his name with country singer Mark Chestnut, calling him Chesney, Kenny Chestnut, or Mark Chesney. But his perseverance paid off. By 2002, Chesney was headlining in West Palm Beach, Florida, before about 12,000 people, a milestone he remembers in his memoir. It proved to be a career turning point. I wrote a contract with my soul that night, Chesney writes. Sitting alone in the back of my bus, idling in the parking lot, I made a commitment. No matter what it took, demanded, or required, I was going to give everything to this. Chesney has stayed true to his word and poured his all into his work, which may be why he rarely pauses to bask in the acclaim. He doesn't take the success for granted, telling Newsweek, "This hasn't been easy for me on any level," later adding, "You have to have a certain discipline, and I learned that discipline from where I grew up and from my family. I'm very, very proud of that." Crystallized in his 1996 hit, Back Where I Come From, Chesney often uses the word pride to describe his roots and upbringing. Never taking much never taken much with material things, Chesney says, "The thing I'm most grateful for in my life is the gift of creativity. I'm so happy about that. To give the world something that didn't exist yesterday is a gift." Music as sport. While he hung up his cleats after his senior year of high school, he didn't leave behind the lessons of football and often compares his band and crew to a team. "What I learned in sports," he tells Newsweek, "is that when you try to accomplish something together, it is really magical when you do it. And doing what we do out there every night and playing the places that we play, it's not an individual sport." In both his book and interview, Chesney frequently frames success as our and we, constantly crediting his team and those who have supported him as part of the play. During his Country Hall of Fame induction speech, he said, "I might be the one the spotlight's on, but I didn't get here alone. I know I didn't get here alone." Even more than the team aspect, Chesney's life resembles the flow of sports. He tells Newsweek, "My life is just like a baseball season as far as the timeline. We got 6 months on and 6 months off." When he's not on the road performing, he's often at what he calls paradise, St. John Island in the U.S. Virgin Islands. "The place holds a special spot in his heart for its beauty, spirit, and community," he says. "Yes, it's paradise, but paradise is not the same without the people." On the island, Chesney is just another neighbor, with his feet in the sand, trading easy hellos with locals over drinks. The island songs, all that's really authentically written and lived, he says. "Part of the power of music is its ability to transport people," Chesney says, noting that his 2004 hit, "When the Sun Goes Down," takes him to the bow of a boat in the Virgin Islands. Another sunshine-filled, beachy hit was born near the equator shortly after, when Chesney performed at Van Halen star Sammy Hagar's highly sought-after birthday bash in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. Beyond the flow of tequila, party, and music, Chesney, then 36, was taking stock of his life, feeling the weight of expectations and the push and pull of fun and having life figured out. His 2005 hit, "Beer in Mexico," was born that weekend, written under the Mexican stars in one night. "While many hear it as a party track, it's about a real transition in my life," Chesney confesses. "We all think we have to have our life figured out by a certain time, and I was nowhere close. I'm still learning, honestly," he says. "But in that moment, all I need tonight is my guitar, my friends, and this beer in Mexico, and it will come." And so that's one of my favorite songs that I've ever wrote. No Shoes Nation. As Chesney's unique blend of country and rock kept climbing the charts, his crowds began to swell, especially after his 2002 album, No Shoes, No Shirt, No Problems, which sold more than 4 million copies. Maintaining his connection with fans starts long before the first note of the night. Chesney says his favorite moment is in the build-up to a performance. He often climbs to the nosebleeds of the stadium he's playing to, that seat as far from the stage as you can possibly get, he writes, to gauge the distance, the feel, and figure out how to reach the people back there. The ritual seems to trace back to Knoxville, Tennessee, when a young Chesney found himself with last-minute tickets on the backside of a concert, an experience he recalls in his memoir, "For me, I never want anybody left out, because I've been there." His inclusionary sentiment also applies to No Shoes Nation, a stadium-sized fan community bound by a shared vibe and a long-running affinity for his music and outlook. Chesney says No Shoes Nation is more than a group of people. It's a state of mind. It's a positive energy, full of love, state of mind. Fans are connected online and in person, often coordinating and tailgating together before shows. It's the music that brings us all together, and I think that's very powerful, he says. As he put it in his book, his mother showed me that good energy multiplies. It draws people to you because there's nothing better than someone who makes you feel good. It's a thread that carries through his music and his effort to bring people together. The secret to writing any song is finding commonality with people, he tells Newsweek, a through line in his work. Chesney has often found this in collaborations with other artists, including Uncle Cracker on the hit When the Sun Goes Down. With his tattoos, gold tooth, and a raspy voice, Cracker looked and sounded different from Chesney, but common ground came from the soul, how you lived, and what you listened to, not how you were marketed, he said. He's tipped his hat to his heroes, too, lacing his country sensibilities into Bruce Springsteen's One Step Up. Springsteen, having been sent the cover by Chesney, wrote an endearing letter back acknowledging the sensitivity and care Chesney brought to the song. Chesney's care and authenticity are core to his brand. He credits his fans with holding him accountable, saying, "I think that your audience, people out there that consume music, they are truly suckers for the truth, and they can smell a rat when it comes to being disingenuous really quickly." As a performer, Chesney remains himself without oversharing, separating the personal from the political and the public, focusing instead on offering his fans an escape. Politics has repeatedly bled into country music, both in the lyrics and in the stars who sing them. Artists like Kid Rock and Lee Greenwood performed at President Donald Trump's inauguration events, and Jason Aldean's 2023 song, "Try That in a Small Town," ignited a summer firestorm with allegations of racism and xenophobia. Last month, young country star Zach Bryan stirred a heated back and forth over his new song, "Bad News," and its lyrics, critical of ICE. Yet, despite several country artists using their platform to push political agendas, Chesney avoids the fray, seeking to bring happiness and connectivity to his fans rather than ideology. He even put that practice to melody in his 2018 hit, "Get Along," which focuses on shared, everyday gestures. Love, dance, call your mom, make friends, and a chorus that says, "We ain't perfect, but we try." His songs seek to unite people over life's simple pleasures and moments of joy rather than divide over politics. I've never been the kind of artist to use my platform to tell people how to think or how to vote. I don't think it's my place. I don't do it, he says. In a polarized moment, Chesney aims for something simpler, a real community, safe, open, and built to experience the music together. Like any artist, he wants his songs to be remembered, but more than that, he tells Newsweek, he hopes his legacy showcases that he truly cared about people, loved music, loved sports, and loved his family, themes heavily encompassed in his work. However, Chesney is nowhere near hanging up one of his many iconic cowboy hats, adding, "I sincerely hope I haven't written my best song yet." What a great story, interview with Kenny Chesney, who's got this new book that's out now, and you might want to think about looking for it because it sounds like a great book. Kenny Chesney, Heart, Life, Music. I'm not a big, huge country music star. I don't really know one person's music from another, but I got to tell you, I have a lot of newfound respect for Kenny Chesney based on what I read here. Seems like a really great guy. He's got a great message, and he's just out there playing music and connecting with fans and helping everybody just to get along, like his song said. We are missing that in this country right now. We are definitely missing this theme of getting along, and maybe Kenny Chesney can do a little bit just to help us to get there. Our next story is more political and governmental, but I think that's important to guys as well. I mean, you know, we live in this country and we vote, hopefully you vote, and we all have opinions and leanings, whether it's to the left or the right or the moderate or whatever. And I think it's important to hear what's going on in the world, regardless of who you vote for, you know, I'll bring you stories occasionally on Trump and the right, and I'll bring you stories on from the left, and then try to keep this thing balanced as much as I can, but I won't overwhelm you with government and politics. But this one's, hopefully you'll get something out of this. We'll see. This is from Time Magazine, November 10, 2025. The cover is a picture of Donald Trump. And the title of this week's magazine is Trump's World. And whether you like it or not, it is. Right now, it is Trump's World. We're all just living in it. And this particular article is about something that he was able to accomplish that I don't think too many people thought he'd be able to do. Now, we'll see where it goes, you know. But this is a report on the Middle East and how the deal got done. Inside Trump's unconventional Middle East diplomacy. On the evening of October 4th, Donald Trump called Benjamin Netanyahu to deliver a message. The war in Gaza was over. Trump's envoys had brokered a deal with mediators from Qatar, Egypt, and Turkey to end 2 years of bombardment and bloodshed. The following Monday, the president told Netanyahu they were going to announce the agreement, and the Israeli premier had to accept it. "Bibi, you can't fight the world," Trump told them, recounting their conversation in an interview with Time. "You can fight individual battles, but the world's against you." Netanyahu, of course, pushed back, but Trump wasn't having it. He launched into a profanity-laced monologue, cataloging all he had done for Israel as president, moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, brokering the Abraham Accords that normalized relations between Israel and several Arab states, even joining Israel's strikes on Iran in June. Trump could no longer stand with Netanyahu, he suggested, if the prime minister didn't sign on to the pact. "It was a very blunt and straightforward statement to Bibi," says Steve Witkoff, Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, "that he had no tolerance for anything other than this." Netanyahu's office declined to comment, of course. By the end of the call, Netanyahu had agreed to a two-phase deal that included a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, secured the return of Israeli hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners and detainees, allowed aid shipments into the ravaged enclave, withdrew Israeli forces from parts of the Gaza Strip, and opened negotiations for a final settlement. If it holds, the accord would end the longest war in Israel's history, one that killed some 2,000 Israelis and nearly 70,000 Palestinians. The deal marks a milestone in Trump's ongoing bid to reshape the modern Middle East. During the past 9 months, the president has attacked Iran's nuclear infrastructure and helped degrade its standing in the region. Isolating Tehran hastened the fall of the Assad regime in Syria, and new governments in Damascus and Beirut have signaled a desire to restore ties with Washington. He has bombed Houthi targets in Yemen, leading to an agreement that the rebel group would no longer target U.S. vessels in the Red Sea. Now he has used a real estate dealmaker's sensibility, an instinct for leverage, for cajoling counterparts through flattery and the threat of force to push a peace deal on Hamas and Netanyahu, two seemingly intractable enemies. The U.S. president is breaking all the long-held assumptions of Middle East diplomacy, says Michael Oren, the historian and former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. Trump is coming back and saying, "We're going to reestablish America's hegemony here," and he's done it so far. Trump traces his achievements so far to his willingness to use America's military might. Through the assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in his first term and his decision to strike three Iranian nuclear facilities last spring, Trump earned enough goodwill among the Israeli public and stirred enough fear among the nation's adversaries to bring both parties to the bargaining table. "It would have been impossible to make a deal like this before," Trump says of his attacks on Iran. "No president was willing to do it, and I was willing to do it. And by doing it, we had a different Middle East." Of course, the ceasefire remains fragile, and the deal could still unravel. Hamas has yet to return the remains of all the deceased Israeli hostages, prompting Israel to close the Rafah crossing and restrict aid. Videos on social media show Hamas gunmen executing rivals in the streets. On October 19th, Israel accused the militant group of violating the ceasefire after attacks on Israeli soldiers. In the span of a week, the situation grew precarious enough that Trump dispatched Vice President J.D. Vance to the region in a bid to hold the agreement together. The next phase is even thornier. It includes defining the scope of Israel's military withdrawal and the structure of a peacekeeping force, disarming Hamas, and determining who will govern post-war Gaza. "There are very difficult things to do," says Dan Shapiro, the former U.S. ambassador to Israel under Barack Obama. Among the risks, Shapiro says, is that Trump could end up with kind of a frozen conflict in the current situation, with Israel controlling half of Gaza, Hamas controlling the other half, suppressing its own people, and no real reconstruction. For those reasons, experts fear the peace may prove fleeting, but Trump's foreign policy has also defied the predictions of his critics. His America First creed, once synonymous with isolationism and retreat, has evolved into an unconventional form of personalized diplomacy, unburdened by doctrine. While he has shown himself content to let Russia have greater dominance over Europe and China, exert its will in the Indo-Pacific region, he's asserted U.S. power in the Middle East in surprising ways. Trump has deepened Washington's ties with Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, and Doha. He expects Saudi Arabia to normalize ties with Israel and join the Abraham Accords by year's end. He tells Time he intends to visit Gaza soon as U.S. partners hammer out a plan to reconstruct the Strip. Soon he envisions greater economic integration between Israel and its Arab neighbors. The bullish vision of what all this could mean would be transformative. Rail lines from the Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf, free trade agreements between Israel and its neighbors, the establishment of a new regional energy grid, Saudis vacationing in Tel Aviv, for God's sakes. In Trump's telling, this regional reset would be impossible without one essential ingredient, himself. The most important thing, he tells Time, is they have to respect the President of the United States. The Middle East has to understand that. It's almost the President more than the country. He's always humble, right? Trump was en route to Charlie Kirk's funeral on September 21st when he summoned his top aides and allies to his private cabin aboard Air Force One. Gathered around the table were his chief of staff, Susie Wiles, House Speaker Mike Johnson, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Witkoff was patched into the conversation by phone. The group had a problem to deal with. Hours earlier, Israeli warplanes had struck Hamas operatives in Doha who were visiting a compound to discuss ceasefire negotiations. The attack violated the sovereignty of Qatar, a U.S. ally and the chief mediator with Hamas. The assault enraged Trump. That was terrible, Trump says now, calling the decision a tactical mistake on Netanyahu's part. Yet for U.S. negotiators, it also represented an opportunity. The assault was a warning to Arab leaders that the war in Gaza would not stay confined there. Trump, meanwhile, saw a chance to use the outrage over the attack to coax regional leaders to the table. This was one of the things that brought us all together, Trump says. It was so out of joint that it sort of got everybody to do what they have to do. If you took that away, we might not be talking about this subject right now. The president's approach to the region took shape in his first term. He entered office without foreign policy experience. He handed the Middle East portfolio to Kushner, his son-in-law and a fellow real estate developer, who approached the matter less as a traditional diplomat than as a dealmaker. When Trump followed through on his campaign vow to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and move the U.S. embassy there, the Palestinians broke off contact with Washington. That rupture gave rise to a new approach to the long-standing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Rather than accept the conventional wisdom that Israel could not integrate with the Arab world without first making peace with the Palestinians, Trump's team sought to flip the formula. They called it the outside-in strategy, build peace from the periphery inward. During the 2024 campaign, Trump was in touch with Netanyahu. The Israeli prime minister visited him at Mar-a-Lago that July. It was an open secret that Netanyahu was rooting for Trump's return to the White House as President Joe Biden pressured him to halt the onslaught on Gaza. But Netanyahu's relationship with Trump was fraught as well. Trump left office furious at the Israeli leader, first for withdrawing from a planned 2020 joint strike on Soleimani, a claim Israel has denied, and later for becoming one of the first world leaders to congratulate Biden on his election victory in 2020. Netanyahu was eager for a rapprochement. When Time brought up Israel's attacks on Hezbollah and regime change in Syria, the president interrupted. All those attacks were done under my auspices, you know, with Israel doing the attacks, with the pagers and all that stuff. He was referring to Israel's covert operation in September 2024 that targeted Hezbollah officials by detonating thousands of pagers, killing dozens and inflicting a psychological scar on the terrorist group for succumbing to such a sophisticated security breach. Biden was still in the White House and Trump was a candidate. They let me know everything, he says, and sometimes I'd say no, and they'd be respectful of that. A Biden representative declined to comment. A Trump spokesperson later said that the president misspoke and was referring to Israel's recent strike on Doha. After Trump won in November 2024, Witkoff traveled to Washington to meet with key members of Biden's foreign policy team. National Security Council Coordinator for the Middle East, Brett McKirk, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Constrained by the Logan Act's restrictions on private citizens negotiating foreign policy, Witkoff secured approval from the Biden team to hold talks with Israeli and Arab interlocutors. Even as the Biden administration continued its own diplomacy, a new sense of possibility had begun to take hold. Hamas was signaling that they wanted to gain some political capital with the Trump administration, Witkoff told me. Beyond political capital, they were afraid of him. The day before Trump's second inauguration, Israel and Hamas agreed to a ceasefire, and Hamas released 33 hostages. But the fighting resumed in short order. Trying to keep talks on track, Trump had invited Netanyahu to the White House in February when he proposed relocating Gaza's population and remaking the strip into the Riviera of the Middle East. Experts say the outlandish idea galvanized Arab negotiators and regional mediators to expedite a peace process. The president scared the hell out of them when he came up with the Riviera idea, says Nimrod Novik, a former senior advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres and now a fellow with the Israel Policy Forum. Never mind the Riviera, but for them to host 2 million Gazans for the duration of reconstruction or beyond was unthinkable on several grounds. The theater of conflict soon expanded. Israeli forces struck Iran's nuclear facilities in June, unnerving a White House that feared the bombing campaign would derail its efforts at diplomacy. Yet Netanyahu, through careful planning, was able to enlist Trump to join the campaign, according to a senior Israeli official who spoke on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to discuss the conversations. At their meeting in February, Netanyahu had agreed to give Trump a 60-day window to engage in talks with the Iranians on a nuclear agreement, expecting that they would prove fruitless, according to an Israeli official familiar with the matter. When they produced no resolution, Netanyahu launched the attack. At first, a White House official says, Trump was frustrated. The offensive jeopardized the administration's hopes of a nuclear deal with Tehran. But Trump warmed to the idea of joining the strikes, seeing their impact, and concurring with Netanyahu's assessment that the Iranians were trying to manipulate him. On June 22nd, Trump unleashed U.S. bunker buster bombs that crippled Iran's nuclear infrastructure, according to U.S. and Israeli officials. Then Netanyahu targeted Hamas leaders in Doha. The assault provoked a crisis that Kushner and Witkoff were determined not to waste. "We had an opening," Kushner says. "It's just an element of how the president thinks." The pair worked the UN General Assembly circuit, hashing out a 20-point plan with Qatari mediators, Egyptian and Turkish interlocutors, and Israeli officials. The proposal called for an immediate ceasefire and hostage exchange, Israeli security guarantees, the demilitarization of Gaza, and a new civilian governing authority. When the document reached the president, he scheduled a meeting with leaders of Arab states in a large room at the UN on Rosh Hashanah. Joined by Witkoff, Wiles, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Trump began the session, U.S. officials say, with a long soliloquy about ending the killing and achieving a lasting peace, the goal that has eluded statesmen since the founding of Israel. Then he went around the table, soliciting each leader's counsel. Prince Faisal, representing the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and King Abdullah of Jordan voiced support for the framework. The negotiations picked up steam from there. Regional leaders, including the Turks and Qataris, helped lean on Hamas. Turkey, a member of NATO, provided a boost by offering Hamas's political leaders protection from Israeli strikes if they came to the table, says Soner Kagapite, the Turkish scholar at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Turkey has quite a bit of sway over Hamas's political wing, he says, and I think Ankara used that influence. Trump applied pressure too, warning that if the militant group refused to disarm or attempted to subvert the deal, it would face complete obliteration. The demand was clear. The return of every Israeli captive, no longer in stages, I said. No more of that. You're giving us the fucking hostages, all of them, Trump says. The threat drew credibility from the recent strikes on Iran. The real clincher was Trump's willingness to use military force, says Oren. The previous Democratic administrations were very averse to using military force. They preferred soft power. Soft power is not widely respected in the Middle East. Trump's popularity in Israel, where his approval ratings dwarfed the Israeli premiers, gave him leverage over Netanyahu. He knew to embrace Netanyahu in public while pressuring him in private to halt the fighting, aides say. He would have just kept going, Trump tells Time. It could have gone on for years. It would have gone on for years. But I stopped him, and everybody came together when I stopped him. That much may be true, but Israelis and Palestinians alike understand that success of Phase 2 will depend on Trump's willingness to stay engaged, on his leverage with Netanyahu, and his influence over the region's key players. If the guarantors of this process want it to succeed, it will succeed, particularly the Trump administration, says Khalid El-Ginji, a former Palestinian Authority negotiator. But there are also ways, he adds, that the pact could crumble. One question is the extent with which an international peacekeeping force will allow the Palestinians to choose their own future governance. Israelis and other Arab powers insist Hamas cannot play a role. But the Islamist group, which the U.S. classifies as a terrorist organization, is not going to negate itself as a political movement, El-Jindi says. I don't think folks in Israel are open to any kind of Hamas participation in anything going forward, and that even if Hamas consents to a technocratic government, they will see that as illegitimate. Trump himself may care little about the specifics of Gaza's post-war order so long as he can claim credit as a peacemaker. That's true. But it's difficult to negotiate when there is no unified Palestinian leadership, a dynamic Netanyahu spent decades cultivating by keeping Hamas in Gaza, and the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority in the West Bank divided. They don't have a leader right now, Trump tells me, at least a visible leader. And they don't really want to because every one of those leaders has been shot. It's not a hot job. Trump says he likes Mahmoud Abbas, the aging head of the Palestinian Authority, but suggests it's unlikely he would be the right leader to lead post-war Gaza. One option is calling on Israel to release Marwan Barghouti, the imprisoned Fatah leader who has spent more than two decades behind bars for allegedly directing the murder of four Israelis and one Greek Orthodox monk during the Second Intifada. It was literally being confronted with that question about 15 minutes before you called, Trump says, so I'll be making a decision. Many regional observers believe Barghouti is the only figure capable of uniting the Palestinians. Polls show him as a leading candidate in a hypothetical election for president of the Palestinian Authority. Netanyahu, meanwhile, faces rebellion from right-wing ministers who want to block a path to Palestinian statehood and annex the West Bank. Trump warns such a move would meet fierce U.S. resistance. It won't happen because I gave my word to the Arab countries, he told me. Israel would lose all of its support from the United States if that happened. Already, he has had to enforce the deal's terms, sending Vance to Israel to ensure that neither Netanyahu nor Hamas allow the agreement to unravel. Netanyahu briefly halted humanitarian aid to Gaza, citing Hamas's failure to return the bodies it had promised and its attacks on Israeli targets, while Vance, Kushner, and Witkoff pressed ahead with reconstruction talks to sustain momentum. In the meantime, Trump's gaze has shifted beyond Gaza. He wants to expand the Abraham Accords, most dramatically through normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have placed two conditions on the table: an end to the fighting and a credible path toward Palestinian sovereignty, even if not necessarily full statehood. Trump believes that both are within reach. I think Saudi Arabia is going to lead the way, he says. We don't have the Iran threat anymore. We don't have any threats anymore. We have peace in the Middle East. Well, that's a little simplified, but because it does go on to say this. Peace in the Middle East is, of course, a florid exaggeration. Yet Trump has achieved a ceasefire that returned the last living hostages to Israel and, for a moment at least, opened the door to a new chapter in the region. Israel was so intent on the hostages, I was actually surprised, Trump says. You would have thought they would have sacrificed the hostages in order to keep going, right? The people of Israel want the hostages more than they wanted anything else, and we got the hostages. The question now is not only whether the fragile architecture of the deal will hold, it's whether Trump can sustain the kind of focus required to turn a momentary reprieve in the fighting into something lasting. It would require the kind of obsessive focus that Jimmy Carter brought to Camp David. Long nights, endless details, a diplomacy of sheer endurance. When I ask whether the new regional dynamic can outlast him, Trump doesn't hesitate. While I'm there, it's going to only get better and stronger, and it's going to be perfect, he says. What happens after me? I can't tell you that. That was an amazing article about how we got to where we are right now with a peace accord, a ceasefire at least, in the Middle East, and how that occurred in a lot of great detail. It was very enlightening. And I don't care whether you're a Trump supporter or not, and I'll tell you right now, I'm not, but this is an amazing accomplishment. Whether it lasts or not, who knows? Like the article said, you know, I mean, people have been talking about peace in the Middle East for 70 years. So, and probably really actually thousands of years, more than likely. And to think that this could be all taken care of right now is probably premature, but it's working for now. And you know what? Sometimes you got to give credit where credit is due. And I think Trump and his envoys have done a great job getting us to at least this point. So we'll have to watch and see what happens in the coming months and years. And next we have article from Sports Illustrated, December 2025 issue. This one's about NFL football. And you may have noticed that the kickoff process is way different than it used to be. And so it's gone through some changes in the last couple of years. And this year's change was pretty dramatic, and that's what this article's about. Kicking it up a notch. The third phase of the game had been NFL's forgotten frontier, but those at the forefront of a special teams revolution this season are finding an edge in unexpected ways. Back in March, Florida State held its pro day on campus in Tallahassee. The main attractions for most talent evaluators were cornerback Aziri Thomas, who would be drafted in the third round by the Jets, and defensive tackle Joshua Farmer, a future Patriots fourth rounder. But among the 18 players who worked out that day, the one who may end up having the biggest impact on the 2025 NFL season is kicker Ryan Fitzgerald. And not because, as coverage of the event noted, he nailed a 68-yard field goal in front of scouts. After most attendees had left, Fitzgerald had an hour-long semi-private meeting with a few curious team reps. Dan Orner, a private kicking coach who'd been working with Fitzgerald for a few years, says scouts from the Browns and Giants asked his pupil to go through an additional battery of workouts that showcased what Orner calls the kicker's bag of tricks. For a year, Fitzgerald and Orner had been practicing ways to knuckleball a kickoff with just this moment in mind. The importance of that conversation would become less clear than 2 weeks later when NFL owners voted at their annual meeting on April 1st to tweak the touchback rule. Offenses would now get the ball at the 35-yard line rather than the 30. You may have missed the change at the time since everybody was screaming about the legality of Eagles' tush push, which was hotly debated at the meetings. Over the last five seasons, drives that began at the 30-yard line scored a touchdown or field goal at a rate of 37.4%. Drives that began at the 35-yard line scored at 44.8%. A touchback that put the ball at the 32 or 33 might still have made kicking the ball out of the end zone a smart play. But inside the NFL analytics community, the consensus is that the 5-yard difference equated to a statistically significant addition of expected points. Suddenly, teams were far more wary of handing an opponent a touchback, and some of them became extremely interested in alternative kickoffs that would hit the ground in the landing zone and allow the coverage team to leave its stationary position. A ball that bounced unpredictably and was difficult to field would be a significant bonus. With all that in mind, those curious souls in Tallahassee watched as Fitzgerald showed how he can keep his leg swing consistent, but based on the tilt of the ball, the placement of the tee, or the strike point, make the ball behave in strange ways. For one of his knuckle kicks, Fitzgerald, a right-footed kicker, tees the ball up like a left-footed kicker would, making it look a little bit curved like an N parentheses. The higher the strike point toward the ankle and the higher the strike point on the football, the more the ball dances in the air. The scouts asked if Fitzgerald could disguise his intentions, making a knuckle kick windup and a traditional windup look identical. He could. They asked if he could keep the knuckleball action consistent from the right to the left. He could. They basically said, please don't show this to anyone else, Orner said. And that's when I said to Ryan, congratulations, you just made the NFL. Fitzgerald ended up signing with the Panthers as an undrafted free agent. The obscurity of his unique kicks and those of another of Orner's clients, the Rams' Joshua Carty, didn't last long. Through the first 7 weeks of the season, Los Angeles, 26.1-yard line, and Carolina, 26.2-yard line, ranked second and third in average opponent starting field position after kicks. The last-place team in that stat, the Jets, surrendered more than 8 additional yards per drive start, resulting in a nearly 15% improvement in opponents' scoring chances. The sudden weaponization of the kickoff has been just one aspect of a special teams revolution this season. Through week 7, there have been 17 blocked field goals and punts, with 3 of them directly deciding the outcome of a game in the final seconds. More 50-plus yard field goals were being attempted per game than at any time in NFL history. More field goals of any distance were being made than ever. The number of kick returns per game quadrupled from 2024. Seemingly overnight, an aspect of football once seen as an excellent opportunity for spectator bathroom breaks was sparking some hard questions. Should practice time be reallocated for special teams? How should kickers, punters, and returners be valued? What really makes a good special teams coordinator? Should more starters be playing special teams? And yes, should parents be buying their grade school kickers tile brush power tool attachments so they can doctor their kicking balls like the professionals? Too late, it's already happening. Jones Bones Fossil of the Titans, one of the league's most experienced special teams coordinators, says that in the best possible way, his reaction has been, what is going on? He and many other coaches say this season has sparked new levels of intellectual curiosity and creativity around the kicking game. Special teams are the wild, wild west, Fossil says. You just don't know what's going to happen. In the spring of 2024, 3 men walked onto a vacant practice field in Houston, determined to figure out what the future might look like. Frank Ross, the Texans' special team coordinator, is one of the league's most successful and the winner of the final 2 Rick Goslin special teams rankings. The legendary Dallas sports writer, who retired the list after the 2023 season, created a 22-point cooking rubric for kicking game units that became the industry standard for rating special teams. Ross, assistant special teams coordinator Will Burnham, and hybrid assistant Sean Baker stood roughly 7 yards apart from one another and started experimenting with the bones of what a new dynamic kickoff might look like if it ever came to the NFL. There was nothing to work off of save of tape from the XFL, the alternative league, which featured a similar kickoff. They started working through their own theories, playing the roles of kickoff blockers or coverage men. Ross would ask Burnham if, in a certain situation, he could track him down at a certain angle. To the uninitiated, it may have looked a bit like synchronized swimming practice on dry land. Ross says it was a bunch of 5'10" white guys and describes the movements on the field that day as not explosive. That day, Ross created what he calls feedback loop, a hard file of a running dialogue with his players that is still in use. Because everything was created from scratch, everything was tailored to the abilities of the players at his disposal. Was any of this comfortable for them? Were the movements coaches were asking them to make feasible? It wasn't necessarily about X's and O's, Ross says. What do you want your feet to look like? How do you envision yourself? This sounds silly, but do you want your butt in or out to the sideline? Anytime there's a change, then it's a race to who can figure it out, Burnham says. So I'd say the first feeling was excitement because you're really throwing out a lot of years of football. This moment reflected the true malleability of special teams from 2024 to the present day. There are raging debates over the use of larger players, tight ends, linebackers, fullbacks, and defensive ends on kickoff returns, and how overall roster construction can favor or adversely impact kickoff unit personnel. Kickoff returns will evolve constantly over the next few years, coaches predict. The evolution extends beyond kickoffs. Take the boom in longer field goals. Kicking experts like Orner say that outside of the fact that teams are now allowed to prepare K-balls throughout the week to make them more kicker-friendly instead of only on game day, the biggest change in the kicking game is that kickers are now plucked from a much more athletic pool and have become less dependent on wedge-style kicking. This method, which uses the inside of the foot, was accurate but sacrificed power. Now, according to Orner, young kickers are more likely to also be track athletes or stars in other sports. Kicks are recorded with the precision of Tiger Woods' backswing and examined for the smallest of adjustments. Middle schoolers have personal kicking coaches. Orner also believes that college football's mass import of kickers and punters from Australia raised the bar for American kickers who had to compete with far more natural and experimental kickers. In the first 7 weeks of this season, teams attempted 119 field goals of 50 yards or more. That number has been climbing in recent years. As recently as 2020, there were only 168 attempted all season. The very real possibility that someone will soon make a 70-yard field goal, the likes of which Jaguars kicker Cam Little hit in the preseason, would then seem to be the culmination of these parallel transformations. But Ross wonders if we're missing something. "I'll ask you a question," he says over the phone just a few days before the Texans took on the Seahawks in Week 7. "Who's a better shooter, Ray Allen or Steph Curry?" He continues, "There's an argument for both. I probably would say Steph, but Ray Allen was at one point the all-time leading three-point shooter, right? Well, Steph necessarily isn't a better shooter, but he changed the game because he was more confident to shoot from different spots further away. So is Cowboys kicker Brandon Aubrey a better kicker than former Patriots kicker, five-time NFL scoring leader, and four-time Pro Bowler Stephen Kuskowski? Or is Brandon Aubrey just shooting from different spots?" Another point of division, kick blocks. Through Week 7, the league was on pace for 30 field goal blocks. There were 18 last year in total. Some NFL coordinators blame the surge on a hangover from the preseason, where teams don't typically rush kickers aggressively and almost never rush them live in practice, like missed tackle numbers that tend to even out once players acclimate to the physicality. Blockers will be less likely to get mauled by more skilled defensive players. However, others concede there's a greater focus on the science behind kick blocking, just as there is on kicking itself. Fossil on the Titans had one of the most visually satisfying extra point blocks of all time in Week 2 against the Rams, when Arden Key arrived in front of kicker Carty fully in rejection mode, arms rising above his head in the shape of a diamond, and swatting the ball half a field away. "You could hear the ricochet off his elbow and face mask, and it shot like 40 yards backward," Fossil says. "Yeah, that's cool." In Week 3, the Eagles blocked Carty on two consecutive field goal attempts, utilizing a rush scheme that bludgeoned one of the Rams' protectors in the outer C-gap and performed what coaches call a corkscrew action to penetrate the vacant space. The attack was so precise that the Rams tried to counter, it didn't work, by replacing one of its blockers from one kick to the next. Clearly, Philadelphia knew the pressure point it was trying to expose. It could be all of this, knuckleball kicks, longer field goals, and increased number of blocks, are at least somewhat connected. Mike Wistoff, one of the NFL's most recognizable special teams coaches, who retired after a 33-year career last year, feels that kickers attempting 70-yard field goals are unconsciously lowering the angle of the ball, a necessity to drive it longer distances, thus making it easier to block. And the inability to protect kickers may be a kind of breaking point of roster construction. Reserve offensive linemen, backup tight ends, and defensive players, some of whom make up the protection units on field goals and PATs, are worse and less experienced as blockers than ever before. This was an inefficiency ripe for taking advantage of, especially since, as special teams coordinators can universally attest, none of them were given an increase in practice time during the week to solve all the issues. Commissioner Roger Goodell, when asked about the new kickoff during the league's international series, admitted there was an intentionally intentionality behind bringing special teams to the forefront, though fixing one problem could have another effect. Regardless, everyone touching the sport feels it. Longtime kick returners like Jamal Agnew of the Falcons says he feels revived, no longer relegated to internally watching Tuxpatch kicks overfly over his head. I always want to take it out on every kick, he says. Kickers are emboldened, with some in their circles wondering if dominating field position means bigger paydays. Most kickers in the NFL make less than $4 million per season. Coaches, Ross says, have more access to varsity players than before. Ross also says something one can imagine many special teams are thinking, but aren't quite ready to say out loud. They have long been ignored for bigger opportunities. The Ravens' John Harbaugh is the only current NFL head coach with a majority special teams background, and even he had to spend a year as defensive position coach before being hired by Baltimore. And no special teams coordinator has ever won the Assistant Coach of the Year award. But now special team specialists are seeing a public legitimization of private mastery. Special teams is not just a slack hire anymore, Ross says. It's a factor. It matters, and I think it's going to continue to shape the game. This is going to be the future, an opinion that Orner shares with many special teams coaches who believe knuckle kicks are just the beginning. I watch that stuff and people would think I'm crazy, he says, but I'm not crazy when two of my guys, Fitzgerald and Carty, are leading the league in field position percentage. Orner says that Fitzgerald, for instance, has yet to debut in any NFL game a version of his knuckle kick that does not require any steps to lead in. He imagines that by week 13 or 14, Fitzgerald will be able to debut the real cool ones. When pressed for details, he says Fitzgerald and Carty can kick balls that have a helicopter-style spin. Balls that with their right foot can mimic the banana-like wobble of a left-footed punt, and with less consistency, something he refers to as a Texas tornado. It spins like a tornado when it hits the ground, and it'll run back 15 yards, he says, just like Rory McIlroy's pitching wedge. We've been working on this for 3 or 4 years and finally got some distance to it. With this in mind, recent Giants practice took on an entirely different vibe. Silence across a chilly, sun-splashed field in East Rutherford, New Jersey, was broken by the loud thwomp of a football barreling end-over-end through a jugs machine toward return man Gunnar Oslikshu, who was stimulating his task for the week ahead. As the wind picked up and the angle of the machine was altered, some of his balls drifted left or right. One of them died at his feet and bounced off his shin. The Giants have two rugby players, punter Jamie Gillen and Scottish-born rugby player and kicker Jude McAtamy, an Irish-born former Gaelic football player who can hit knuckleball kickoffs in practice. A third long snapper, Casey Kreider, is spotted sometimes attempting knuckleball kickoffs, and his special teams coordinator asked, "What are you doing, dude?" Gobrel, who coaches one of the best kickoff coverages in the NFL, says he could probably hit a knuckleball too, just not on purpose or know where it would land. His joke broke the seriousness of what was otherwise a display of how deeply he cares about his life's vocation. He wasn't buying the idea that this day-to-day experience amid special teams was necessarily different for him, because the level of special teams has always been held with the most utmost regard. He adds, "It's why I do what I do." Still, he admits that now everyone's watching the opening kickoff, everybody's watching the return, and the extra every field goal and punt and extra point. It matters in a very specific sense as it pertains to expected points and field position and the little moments that now define wins and losses like never before. But it also matters because something, a way of life out there on that sunny practice field and thousands everywhere just like it, was about to die. To have it back, he says, just minutes before donning a royal blue jacket and lining up his punt unit is exceptional. So I guess special teams are relevant again.